The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
And welcome to our weekly podcast. It's Oliver Callan here, who's filling in for Ryan Tuberty this week. It's a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days. Derek Scally talked to me about Ireland's complicated history with the Catholic Church, which he explores in his debut book, The Best Catholics in the World. Great book, by the way. I suggest you support it. Sports broadcaster and Derry native Orla Shinawi spoke to me about covering major sporting events like the Olympic Games and the Tour de France, and what it's like to be a woman and a mother working in sport today. Fashion revolutionary Ursula de Castro told me why we need to rethink our approach to what we wear and how we wear because of the impact on both the planet and its people. And novelist and journalist Matt Haig talked to us about his new bestseller, The Midnight Library, which tells the story of someone wishing for a better life and realizing that what they had in the first place might not have been so bad after all. So that's it. Thanks a million for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. It's a great title for a book, The Best Catholics in the World, by the Irish Times Berlin correspondent of the last 20 years, Derek Scally. It's his first book. It's already sparked very interesting conversation about our recent dark past, you know, wondering who's to blame for all the scandals, whether we've actually reckoned with all of that dark history as a country. And it sounds heavy, but it's actually a very pacey and entertaining read. Let's find out more. So good morning to you, Derek.
Good morning, Oliver.
You're in Berlin.
I am.
And you took off to Germany as you were a young man. I didn't realise that how long you were actually the Berlin correspondent over there.
No, it's true. I mean, most people who come to Berlin, they just plan to stay for a little while, but it's a bit like that Circus Island in Pinocchio. A lot of people tend to stay. And I think anyone who comes to plan to stay in Berlin doesn't tend to, but people who just want to drop in for a few minutes, you know, they find themselves there 20 years later. And I think that's my story.
So what possessed you from Berlin to write this book on, it's a subject that most of us don't really want to dwell on a whole lot, is it?
No, it's true. I think it was kind of like a collision of my Irish past and my German present. I go back and forth, at least until the pandemic began, over and back to Ireland quite regularly. It's a 2-hour flight. But as time passed, I just found like I increasingly had this niggle. Like I thought at first it was like an emigrant's niggle towards the country I'd left. And I kept saying to myself, well, Ireland has transformed itself beyond recognition in the 20 years I've been away. It's a more open, it's more tolerant place. And yet we're very silent on what went before. And yeah. I thought to myself, well, if we're so open and tolerant and cosmopolitan, now what's the problem? Why don't we talk about what happened before, about the 80s? Maybe we don't quite like the version of ourselves that we were back then. And I thought to myself, isn't it remarkable? We've had 20 years of reports and revelations and recriminations. And I wondered, is it possible that we're actually no closer to actually understanding how the Catholic Church had such a hold over Ireland and how we existed vis-a-vis the Catholic Church? And I started speaking to people and I realised there actually isn't any agreement on this. And I was so bothered by it. I actually sought out Mary Collins. Your listeners might know her. She was abused by a priest in the 60s. Yeah. And she's become a very vocal advocate for survivors and critic of the church. But the priest who abused her was in our parish in the 1990s on the north side of Dublin. And when I met Marie, I said, look, Marie, we've had three passes at this. We've looked at, you know, the abusing priests, then there was the cover-up of the bishops, and then we had the whole church-state collusion part. And I said, but what about the next stage? Like, when do we get to us? And she said, actually, Derek, I've been waiting 20 years for somebody to ask me that question. Wow. So I wrote about it in the Irish Times, and then I got a call from Penguin, and they said, could I imagine writing a book?
Wow. So it's fascinating because it's both the insider and the outsider's view. And it is that outside perspective that you bring to it that kind of makes us ask questions that we don't even think of asking ourselves half the time. What I want to do actually is just go back, because the book begins as kind of a sort of short history of the church here. And I remember in school, we revered these kind of brave monks who wrote beautiful books, the Book of Kells and all these lovely things, and fought off Vikings. But among the saints and scholars, I didn't know anything about this, were slaves.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It's been hiding in full view. I mean, we all know in school that St. Patrick was kidnapped. St. Patrick was a slave. Yeah. We celebrate St. Patrick's Day. People who might want to have nothing to do with the Catholic Church are celebrating a saint and the apparent coming of Christianity, but they're also celebrating a slave. And most of early Catholic Ireland was slavery was a huge component. For every monk who was sitting in a shady part of a monastery writing the Book of Kells, who was feeding him? Who was keeping him safe? You know, there was huge amount of slavery. And there were, you know, when you look back at the original manuscripts, there's people talking about people giving up their children to the monasteries for who knows what reasons. So we've idealized our past, I think, to maybe make the present even more bleak. But I mean, there was never really an ideal time. And I think how we look back in the early days is almost, it's a reflection of our emotional needs. It's almost like we want to make ourselves feel worse. But the early days of the church, you know, St. Patrick was a slave. He wasn't the only one. So we're encouraging other people to, or demanding that the British and other people look at their histories of slavery. Well, Catholic Ireland has its roots in slavery and in child abuse, and some glorious things in Catholicism opened Ireland to the world, and it made it a more sophisticated place. So it's ambivalence, and I think we struggle in Ireland with ambivalence, you know, with the glory and the shame, and I think my book is really about the silence we show towards that ambivalence. We don't really know how to begin thinking about it, so we just remain silent. And I think unless we embrace the ambivalence of our Catholic past and our personal Catholic past, we're not really going anywhere.
And again, the penal laws, I used to picture the Liam Neeson-style priests smuggling chalices and saying renegade masses under cover of darkness at rocks and so on. And this, you know, the plucky Catholics doing their popery as the Protestant ascendancy tried to stamp it out. But it's not quite the case, is it?
No, I mean, anyone who's curious, I had an extract in Saturday's Irish Times. It's available online. And again, it's not really quite as simple as that. We are told there was sort of it was a terrible time. It was kind of like an Irish Holocaust. But when you look back, how many priests actually died? Not a huge number. And of course, it was a history of degradation, and it was a history of humiliation, and that carries on to this day. But you have to ask yourself, in whose interest is it for us to have appeared to be like holy victims? It was a 19th century narrative that we can create sort of an Irish, sort of like a coin, two sides of one coin, Irish nationalism on the one side, national identity, on the other side, Catholic identity. And if you bring the two together, you can, of course, explain horrors of the past. It's sort of offering it up. But we also create sort of like a holy victim narrative, which I also think continues into this day. We always like to view of ourselves as victims, but the penal history, just like before and just like since, an awful lot of perpetrators there, and an awful lot of bystanders, and trying to locate ourselves on that narrative, I think, is what my book is about.
That is the thread that runs through it, isn't it? It's that question that who's to blame or who's responsible, I suppose, not just in the institutional abuse. We know who was involved directly in, you know, sexual violence by priests or the incarceration in laundries and mother and baby homes era. But it's not quite as simple as the view that's sometimes put forward, that it was an all-powerful church with their nefarious state allies totally imposed upon an innocent, powerless society.
Yeah, I mean, John McGahan, I think he put it well. He had his own run-ins with the church, and yet he was always clear to separate the institution church from his personal faith. And of the former, the institution, he said, we fashioned a fortress church, and it was like an army. It demanded absolute allegiance. And I'm less interested in, you know, blame, guilt, shame. I think everyone has to decide on that for themselves. But I'm interested in what was the cost of our allegiance to that? Because I think, you know, look at the picture of the Pope's visit. You know, 2.5 million people went to see the Pope. Anyone who was there was part of the story of Irish Catholicism. And to say now I don't go to church anymore, I've broken with that. Yeah, that's fine. But what about your attendance then? You might say, I didn't have any choice to go. Did you? Did you not? And I think it's really not my place to judge people in previous eras and people who grew up in a much harsher, much less tolerant Ireland than mine. But I think we didn't just have one Catholic Ireland. I think we've spent the last 20, 30 years arguing about the church, arguing about guilt, arguing about shame. I think we just basically have to accept we have an ambivalent past. We had at least 4 million Catholic Irelands. Everyone has their own experiences, and we've had centuries of people telling us what to do, what to think. And I think we're more mature people, and we can show that by actually just, you know, are we able to reflect on our own personal experiences? There's an expression I came across which I quite like. It's called the continuum of knowing. And on the one hand, you've got the survivors and the perpetrators, the victims of Catholic Ireland on one end, and right at the far end, you've got the perpetrators, the enablers, the abusers. But most of us are somewhere between those two extremes, and everyone has to really place themselves on that sliding scale. You know, what education did they have? How much power did the church have over them? What was their social standing in a parish? And, you know, I think people need to place themselves. And reading this book is really about me going back to my Ireland and seeing what I saw, wondering why I didn't think certain things. And there's a certain pain there, admitting certain things to oneself. And everyone has their own narrative. So it's really about enabling people to think for themselves and not imposing my narrative on others.
The word deference is a big thing in this book, isn't it? And I mean, what you're talking about there is kind of summed up quite interestingly by President Higgins, Michael D. Higgins. He talks about, is it a colluding silence? Is that the way he puts it?
Yes, a colluding silence. Maeve O'Rourke, who's a campaigner for Magdalen survivors and others, she spoke about a weird silence. She said, you know, silence, it is funny. I mean, my German friends always laugh about how chatty Irish people are, but it's funny. When I went on this journey, I found so many times there was just a silence. People just stopped talking. They literally just stopped talking. Because I think, you know, of course, a certain amount of it is exhaustion, but a certain amount of it is just a whole ambivalence towards the notion of Irish perpetrators. And that goes back to the penal times. You know, this notion that somebody is always doing something to us, the notion that we could do terrible things to ourselves. We struggle with that. We struggle with the us component. We're very good on them. They did things to us. But if we accept that Irish clerical sexual abuse perpetrators were Irish passport holders, things get awkward because we realise that unconsciously we're putting them in sort of a shame containment facility, the way we used to do it with single mothers and with other people who didn't fit our current moral needs. And to realise that certain patterns are deep in us, and regardless of whether you go to Mass on a Sunday, those patterns, there's a risk of them repeating. That's what I think 20 years of living in Germany has taught me. It's not about beating people over the head for something they had no power over then, or something they weren't even alive for. It's just reminding people that patterns continue, patterns repeat. And the German writer Siegfried Lenz, he said, the past doesn't stop, it examines us in the present. So what my book is really, it's about the present. It's about trying to inform myself about Catholicism and then trying to have more informed empathy rather than sort of ill-informed accusations.
Now, you have some very newsworthy bits in it. And we saw over the weekend even your conversations with the retired Cardinal Sean Brady in the news, because you had a kind of a Frost Nixon-style series of interviews with him in the course of doing this book.
Yes, it was quite remarkable. I laugh when you said Frost Nixon on Twitter, because it occurred to me in hindsight that's kind of what it was. I mean, I had a sort of a personal in with Sean Brady. His family and my family sort of knew each other, and Brady went to school with two of my uncles. So when I contacted him, I knew he really wasn't feeling very friendly towards journalists, but I said, would you just talk to me? So we had four meetings and we got to know each other. And at the end of it, I won't say, part of me was hoping maybe I could finally clear up this whole awful story of him and Brendan Boland and Brendan Smith and what he did or didn't do in the 70s and what he could or couldn't have done. I left it feeling very ambivalent. He's a conflicted figure. He's an ambivalent figure. He is very popular in Cavan, but there's a huge sense that he's a flawed individual, and he was really just blind to the suffering of a boy and was convinced that by acting in the interests of the church, he was doing good.
And just because, a bit like David Frost, you still managed to extract some of the strongest words from Sean Brady about his involvement in the church handling of Brendan Smith all those years ago, where he was quite literally saying it's only dawning on him now while he was talking to you, the double victimisation of the kids. Can you remind us of the incident that he's referring to there?
Yes, in 1975, he was asked by his bishop to participate in an interview with Brendan Boland, a boy from Dundalk, who said he, Father Brendan Smith had abused him. And the boy showed up with his father. The priests who were there, including Sean Brady, put the father in front of the door. And then they asked Brendan Boland an extraordinary list of questions about, it was really basically about his own sexuality, sort of implying that somehow he was, I don't know, tempted Father Brendan Smith or something. That seemed to be the implication. But today he says, you know, we were not respectful of the boy's dignity, and it didn't sink in at the time how heinous it was, how premeditated. And he will still say, you know, by filing his report and doing nothing afterwards, that, you know, he had done his job. But he did say, you know, now looking back, it's strange, it didn't cross my mind that I had a moral obligation to report to the guards. It didn't strike me the enormity of it. But people I spoke to, they said, look, Brady would always do what he had promised. He would obey the church and not speak up. And I challenged him on that. And I said, is that your... That has always been your approach, a safe pair of hands. And maybe that's one of the reasons why you rose to become a cardinal and the highest church figure in Ireland. And he would push back against that. He didn't see himself as ambitious. But you know, his actions and his silence certainly didn't do his career any harm. But of course, that's exactly what ended up undermining him in the end.
Now, it's kind of, you kind of say early on in the book that you don't have a particular anger or rage around the church. And as you come towards kind of concluding chapters, you're talking about that we need to maybe commemorate the church in some way using museums and so on, and particularly including in that the good that the church has done in the country.
Yes, I mean, I find it strange. If I brought German friends of mine to Ireland, I can bring them to two literary museums, I can bring them to a leprechaun museum, but I really have nowhere to take them to explain the largest, most powerful influence on Irish history of all time. And I said, I would love to have a place to bring him. And it would be a museum of ambivalence, a museum of contrast. And it would be a place where you can look at something like the Derry na Flann Chalice, but you can also look at, you can flick through, you know, the Murphy Report. I mean, that's as much a part of Irish literary heritage now as Ulysses. Yeah. And we need to understand that it's not black and white. There is a lot of grey. And I think with a museum like that, with archives, with professionals who are helping individuals explore their own past and what choices they had, I think that would be a step on. That would be a sign that we're our mature people. Because, you know, I spoke to many survivors, people like the late Paddy Doyle, a remarkable man, and he said, you know, people seem to think they're helping me or they're sort of making a statement by no longer going to mass, but that solves nothing. He says, you know, unless we engage with our past, we can't really be empathetic towards the present. And the present, like Paddy Doyle or Mary Collins, they all say it's all about the present. You know, you can't help me in the past, but you could help people growing up in bed and breakfast. It's all very well to say on social media how terrible direct provision is, and is that our new mountain laundries? But you haven't done anything. There's no cost putting something on social media. And I think it's just because we don't have access to how we feel about that period that's just passed. And once we access that, it will be tremendous pain, but it's our personal past. And I think that opens us to becoming more compassionate witnesses to survivors in the present.
Because Judge Sean Ryan of the Ryan Report, and I want to read out this quote that he says in an interview with you for the book, he says, how do we take for granted something that now seems obvious to have been brutal and monstrous? And the question for each of us now is, what is present today that I'm overlooking in the same way?
This is the tragedy. I mean, I met so many people along the way who were so conflicted. I mean, one story, a taxi driver, he was driving me to an event with the so-called Magdalen women in Oris, the Oris with President Higgins. And he heard where I was going. And then he told me about how the company he worked for, the taxi company, had a contract to drive women to and from a mother and baby home on the Navan Road. And he used to bring them to and fro to the hospital, St. James's. And in hindsight, he told me, he said, I don't really know what I thought was going on. I don't know if I could have done anything. I feel terrible about it now, but I wasn't sure, and I had a mortgage and so on. He was just a bundle of conflict, and I really wanted to just stay in the taxi with him, and or at least say, well, you know, there's a place you can go, you can talk to people. In Germany, they have lots of institutions like this and institutes and encourage people to explore their own personal Catholic Ireland. I didn't have anywhere to send him. I felt terrible. And I think that's why it's for us. It's, this book is really for the people like me who are feeling conflicted. You know, it's personal. I'm on a farewell tour, but it's yes. I'm bringing you along. I'm not an academic. It's reportage. I'm learning about Catholic Ireland and you are too. And I'm trying to be fair and I'm saying, look, I'm not on any side here. I'm part of the 90% in the middle of the bystanders. And once we admit that we were all bystanders, it's not an accusation. It's more just a statement of fact. And once you admit that, you know, people like that taxi driver or others, I would love to have somewhere to send them. And I think Ireland is in a position now to create institutions and to create opportunities for people to reflect themselves. So maybe this book will encourage people to think.
It certainly starts that conversation. Do you think it'll ever happen? Do you think we'll ever have a museum or even a memorial, which has been recommended 12 years ago in the Ryan report? It was in the Magdalen Laundries report as well. And we've seen nothing.
Well, if you want a memorial, you need to have an agreement among society about what are we remembering?
Right.
And a memorial to those terrible people in the church who did terrible things to us, that's really not a reflection of the complexity of the time. It would have to be a memorial to complicity. It would be a memorial to responsibility. People look at countries like Germany who've gone through two dictatorships in the 20th century and they say, oh yeah, this is the gold standard. It did take Germans 30 years to realise that this, you know, the Nazis were not aliens who landed from a spaceship from a distant planet.
Yeah.
You know, they were, Nazis were Germans and East Germans are doing the same again. And in my book, I look into that. I'm in no way comparing the periods, but it's all about how do we process our historical memory. And eventually, 20, 30 years seems to be the period where people can start to look again.
Wow.
And hopefully this book is coming at the right time for that.
I was fascinated with that because we do sort of, other the churches, you say, we treat them like aliens. It was nothing to do with us. That whole thing was carried out by that thing, which is not connected to us in any way. But the part that touched a nerve with me was your description of the event for the Magdalen Laundry survivors. It was in Dublin City Centre. And the survivors, obviously, so thrilled to be finally recognised to have that state apology. But then you turn to people in the crowd and ask them their views on it. And that's very enlightening as to where we are.
Yes, I mean, it was a remarkable day. I mean, huge credit to everyone who's involved because for the first time, many of these women came together and for the first time, they realised this wasn't their shame. They weren't carrying a burden. And there was huge positive feedback from many people and people will remember the reports at the time and just the sheer joy of those women. But there were other women that day and none of them really made it into the reports. And they were sort of looking around at all this saying, who is this for? Is this for us or is it for them? You know, the Irish, many of them living in England, wondering what on earth was this about. And then later on in the day, they were going to the Mansion House on Dawson Street. And again, people were clapping. And I thought that was wonderful, but it was a bit like what we have now clapping for the NHS. You know, why are we not discussing the circumstances that means all we can do is here, stand and clap? Again, I'm not really criticizing people for wanting to be there, wanting to show support. That's tremendous. But what do we do after that? And that's the question. What is our sustainable, as Michael President Higgins would say, you know, how can we be better ethical witnesses? And I think we can only become better ethical witnesses by going back, realizing that Irish Catholicism was as much Irish as it was Catholic. You know, this notion of Rome rule, we had as much or as little Rome as we wanted. We were well able to, on the one hand, you know, show filial allegiance to Rome. On the other hand, 100 years ago, we were quite able to go to Rome and tell off the Pope's deputy. So, this is an Irish story and, you know, Irish Catholicism is, it's a bit like, you know, Coca-Cola or Guinness. You know, the basic formula is the same, but it's adjusted for local tastes. And how we adjust the Catholicism for our local tastes, our emotional needs, that's the story of Ireland. That's the story of us.
Because it is fascinating, those spectators that day, a lot of them didn't have a clue anything about the Magdalen Laundry. Someone hadn't heard the word before. But a lot of people thought it was all dealt with because it was in the news for a bit and there was the state apology. And now surely that's all been dealt with and they've been looked after and they've said all the things they promised to do in the apologies.
Well, this is the worry is that somehow we think we can draw a line under this. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but this is part of our history. And whether we own or disown that history is ours, is that's what we're facing now. And many people that day seem to think, oh, that's done and dusted. And many of the groups who've been working with these women for years are saying they're worried that that's the problem. But, you know, for every state apology, for every politician apologising, there's an Irish civil servant who's pushing back against this, denying guilt, denying them the human rights, denying them access access to their own stories and files. So there's very much still two Ireland's existing. And I guess these civil servants are acting with a sense of impunity that we once have associated with priests and with bishops. Impunity that there's no pushback, there's no cost to them for locking away these people's pasts. And so for people clapping on the street and for people who think, you know, survivors, well, they never happy, you know, they're just wanting to be treated like human beings with human rights. And we're still putting them in a sort of a vulnerable box rather than viewing them as people. So, you know, that Magdalene event was telling, and it was important and it was necessary and it was a hugely important day for many of the women, but it really didn't solve anything. It showed that we have a need to appear once again as virtuous people who are applauding these people, but we're not interested in asking ourselves, why did we laugh at them when we saw them walking through town 40 years ago?
Well, there's a great reaction anyway. There's a huge reaction, Derek. 51551 is the text. You can email ryan@rte.ie. Interesting talk, really. The Church, have you read James Connolly's collected works? It deals with our real history comprehensively, according to Paul Doran and Clondalkin. The notion that the Catholic Church had a hold over Ireland is a distortion of historical reality. Irish society created the Church. It reflected the values and attitudes of that society. There seems to be a lot of denial about this, as that's texter on Twitter. Someone says, great insights by Derek Scally on Ireland's complicated past with the Church and our response to it in the present. Can't wait to read his book, says Tom O'Connell. Well, the best Catholics in the world. It's out now, is it, Derek?
It is. It's out now, and it's been doing very well. And I know bookshops aren't all open, so it's been remarkable to see it going. And
yes.
It has just a remarkable picture on the cover from Tony Murray. So anyone who wants to see the cover, if you feel at all,
can you describe that to us? Because it really does hit a particular vibe, doesn't it?
Oh, it's got a particular tint. I mean, Tony's picture is extraordinary. It's got a tint. It's sort of a group of children. One child. They're at some. It could be the papal mass. A girl is holding a sign saying, "Jesus, my God, my Lord, my God, my all." There's a man deep in prayer. There's a girl yawning. And right at the center, there's a woman with a particular look, a middle-aged woman looking directly at the camera. And we all know that woman. That was the woman who kept things ship-shape in the parish. And anyone who feels any sense of recognition or shame or shock when they see that picture, I think that book is for you.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating book. And there are very entertaining moments as well. Can you tell us very briefly about the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican City and your trip there?
Yes, I had a remarkable time there. It felt like being in a sort of a David Lynch film. It was just absolutely bizarre. But I was staying with somebody who was a regular visit to the Vatican. His name was Gonzalo. He was a male burlesque dancer, boylesque dancer. And he had remarkable act involving a top hat, a G-string and lots of balloons.
Very Vatican.
And he said, yeah, the Vatican was one of his biggest clients. So, you know, it's the complexity and the ambivalence and the contradictions of Catholicism.
And a very fancy bathroom.
Yes, but they've been. It was. There was some of the most famous paintings of Raphael that nobody will see are available there. But it's. I mean, it's just a complex, glamorous history, and it's for our past. It's not as burdensome as it is. Not dealing with it is really where we need to be.
Well, as I say, there's no judgment in it. It asks us to raise the questions, and there's some very decent proposals in there. If we'd more time, we could go into it. But you can read about them in the book, The Best Catholics in the World. It's an amazing book for the first book you've written as well, Derek. And I mean, it's accessible as well. It's written in that breezy, conversational way. Someone upstairs actually described it was like a Louis Theroux feel to some of the storytelling. But listen, the best luck of the Derek.
Thank you so much, Oliver.
Thanks a million. Good morning to
bye
you.
Bye now.
Back after these. Now, I'm joined by Orla Shenawee, a Derry native who's currently working as a sports broadcaster for Eurosport. She has covered practically every major sporting event from the Olympic Games to the Tour de France and is here this morning to tell us more about what it's like to be a woman and a mother, particularly working in sports broadcasting. Now, there's a little delay on the lines, so I'm just going to go straight in, Orla, because we know you have a great global career, but this being Ireland, we just want to know, first of all, about your background and tell us about your upbringing in Derry.
Good morning, Oliver. Yeah, I know there's a little bit of a delay on the line, so I hope this you can hear me fine. I'm speaking from Amsterdam, where I live at the moment. But yeah, I'm from County Derry, from the countryside, from a little place, Ballinascreen. And sport was just always such a part of my life growing up. I was massively into track and field. I was an athletics nut as a kid, and also football. So without revealing too much about my age, although you could probably Google it anyway, I grew up in the glory days of Derry football. So Sundays were spent piling us all into the back of the car. We'd head to watch and cheer on Derry wherever they were playing, and following them all the way to their glorious Sam Maguire win back in 93, which is a terribly long time ago now. But that's where my love of sport comes from, really, from my mum and dad. They were both very sporty. The whole family was sporty, and just a love of the outdoors, really.
And I mean, you're kind of underselling yourself there. You won the All-Ireland Triple Jump Championship at least twice anyway, from what we've found in our research. you're downplaying a little bit. So you're a sporty person. You're in Derry. What are you thinking about your career then? You go to Queen's University, is that right, in Belfast?
Yeah, I went to Queen's to study law with French. And I think I'm probably like most people at that stage in your life. You don't really know what you want to do. So I had a wide range of jobs that I would have loved. One of them was an Olympian. My dream was to represent Ireland at an Olympic Games. But by the time I got to university, I kind of realised that wasn't going to happen. As you say, I was a triple jumper. There wasn't an awful lot of triple jump coaching for women back then. So I also thought I'd love to be a television, like a kids television presenter when I was a kid, and then I grew out of that. But my enduring love was always with journalism. I always wanted to be a journalist. And so I studied law with French mainly because I quite fancied a year living in France, and I thought that would be very exotic. And I also thought that law would be a great grounding to go into journalism. But I kind of felt a little shy, I guess, back then. I didn't know any other journalists. And so, you know, there's this whole concept of visibility, and if you see it, you can be it. I didn't know anyone else who was a journalist. So I didn't really think certainly television or broadcast journalism was a career that was open to me. So I kind of hoped I'd sneak through law. And by the time I got to the end of that, I'd be brave enough to put my hand up to myself and say, no, this is what you want to do. And that's what happened. So I went on from there to do a postgrad in journalism at Edinburgh, at Napier University in Edinburgh, and took it from there, really.
Did you always know that you were probably going to have to leave, get out of Derry? Because, like, you know, we're all familiar with Derry girls now, and you're growing up in that period of the 90s. You're a kid. It's like a military zone in those days, wasn't it?
It was, Oliver, and it's really odd to look back on that now because it was so normal at the time. And it's one thing that I think Derry Girls has done so well is just reminding us how normalised it was, you know? And when I try to explain to people, because I moved to the UK and then mainland UK and then you know, I moved to Amsterdam, and you try to tell people what it was like growing up, and it seems almost unreal that you had, you know, army in the streets and checkpoints when you were trying to leave home and coming back to home and your boot checked, and, you know, just always this element of fear. But at the same time, what's also quite strange about it is as a kid, it was a very free childhood. You know, I only have happy memories of my childhood, but I think that's as much where I grew up and the community that I was in and the family that I had. And I think, to answer your question, I feel like I did always think I was going to leave to do the job that I wanted to do, but not necessarily because of any political situation, because actually the politics and everything that was going on made Northern Ireland in particular a really interesting place to be a journalist. It was more, going back to what I said earlier, that I was quite shy about my ambitions, and I felt like it's easier to make mistakes where people don't know you. You know, it's easier to be in the radio or the television where people that you know can't listen and can't judge you and can't laugh at you, I guess, which I'm sure nobody would have been doing, but that's what you think when you're starting out. So it was easier for me to be brave somewhere where I didn't know people. I think that was a key element of moving away from home more than anything else.
I think it's interesting you say that, because when you did get your first big TV gig as Ireland correspondent for Sky News, a big blockbuster broadcaster like that, your baptism of fire was in the north, really, wasn't it? And quite a significant moment in the history up there.
Yeah. So I joined in 2005 as Ireland correspondent for Sky at the end of 2005. And shortly after that, George Best passed away. And so they'd been keeping vigil outside the hospital in London where he'd been ill. But of course, then for the funeral, you'll probably remember, it was a huge event in Belfast. And so I was just green at the time. I was so new to broadcasting. And all of a sudden, this huge team of people from Sky in London disembarked into Belfast, and they were, you know, making these huge plans, and we were going to be live all day. And my role for the morning was to be stationed at the end of the street. So for the coffin being taken out and put into the hearse and the beginning of the procession, you know, and as I say, it was such a huge event. There were thousands of people along the street. And I was broadcasting all of that live while we had the helicopter up in the air and Eamon Holmes and Kay Burley were at Stormont. It just felt like I had jumped straight into the deep end. And I mean, that's from a professional sense, but obviously as well, and you're trying to contain your nerves while being incredibly respectful of the event itself, you know, and what George Best meant to so many people. So, yeah, it was a big day in my career, that one. Big one.
Well, you handled it very deftly because your career went on from strength to strength. But you found yourself moving towards sport. How did that kind of process happen?
Well, I initially had thought I wanted to be a war correspondent, so to be a sports presenter is very different. But I joined Sky and thought I would move through those ranks and maybe be stationed in a foreign bureau somewhere. And then the reality of news, I think, just wore me down a little bit. You'll know what it's like. And I mean, anybody who listens to the news will know what it's like. It can be quite a depressing landscape, you know, and it's quite hard to deal with sometimes. Yeah. And I feel like I just needed a little bit of light relief, I guess, really, in my profession. And it was just before the London Olympics that Sky decided they wanted to have an Olympics correspondent. And so I thought, well, actually, this light bulb went off in my head. I remember I wanted to go to the Olympic Games. Yes. I hadn't planned to go as a broadcaster, but I thought I'd apply for that. And, it combined so many different elements of politics and economics and sport, of course. So I applied for that. I got that job. And from there was just no turning back. I absolutely loved reporting on sport and all kinds of sport. And it gave me such fulfillment and such satisfaction. And there was no looking back from that moment.
Well, it was perfect because you brought together your kind of twin passions, because sport, as you said, you basically had to abandon it because there was no training for women in your chosen field of the hop, skip and a jump. And jump the hurdles. I mean, it must have been just such a eureka moment when you're over there at the Olympics. But there must have been a tiny part of you going, if only they had provided the kind of services for women when I was of that age.
I mean, yes and no. The thing is, whenever I started triple jump, it was still new for women, certainly in Ireland. And that's why we didn't have the same training and the same coaching. It was more the novelty as much as anything. But of course, the fact that that women could only compete in it really late was in itself quite a bizarre inequality. But when I started to report on elite sport, I realised, and what fascinated me about it really was that I realised there's something in the genetic, in the psychological makeup of elite athletes that the rest of us just don't have. And it's absolutely fascinating to delve into, because they have something that makes them push themselves further than any of us will ever feel the need to. Mm-hmm. And that can come from anything. It can come from perhaps a darkness within them. It can come from some sort of a motivation whereby they feel constantly they need to prove themselves. They need to show other people just what they can achieve. But there's something that makes them drive themselves. And I realised, and I didn't realise, I guess, until I became Olympics correspondent, that's something that I just didn't have. And I'm an incredibly hard worker. And I do feel like I push myself harder than a lot of people. But there's something about elite athletes that sets them apart. And there's a reason that most of us don't get to fulfill our dreams. You know, it's all very well to be Irish champion, and that took a lot of dedication as a kid. But to make it to that next level just takes something extra that so few of us actually have, I think.
There's a drive, and then there's that Olympic Games drive, which is something else entirely. Now, in the meantime, of course, you get married and you start a family. But your career is unaffected largely.
It was largely unaffected, and that was, I guess it was, like with everyone, a bit of a concern. I am not the best planner sometimes, and so I kind of left it up to life to decide if or when I was going to have a family. And in the end, it worked out, I think, really well, because I had built so much of a career by the time I had my daughter 6 years ago, Eve, that I felt I was able to step away from it a little bit, but still go back knowing that I had all of the experience and I'd proven myself And so it was easier to step back into it again. And I would say even the fact that I've got two kids now, I've got Austin as well, who's two. Yeah. It's a strange thing because you don't know how motherhood in particular is going to affect you. And I hope I'm not doing fathers a disservice, but society is still such that mothers bear either more responsibility, or they're told they should bear more responsibility, or they feel that so much of the family life has to be down to them, whether that's true or not in any given family.
Yes.
And you don't know how that's going to affect you. You don't know how it's going to affect your ambition. And I was nervous about that before I had kids because I really, really loved and still love my job. But I feel almost now, especially because I had a girl first, I almost feel a greater responsibility. I need to be able to show her that she can still continue her career and push for her career regardless of her gender, regardless of whether she has children or not, because I didn't want to be in a situation where I'd worked for all these years. I was 36 when I had, well, I've given away my age now anyway. I was 36 whenever I had Eve, and I didn't want to have worked so hard and given up so much for all those years to then have to put that aside because I thought, well, what was I working for? And of course, when you become a mother or a parent, you understand that being a parent in itself is a full-time job. But I think because I had a daughter, I felt that extra responsibility to show her that doors wouldn't close on her. It was her choice as to what she wanted to do. And that's been a big driver for me, really, in continuing to push my career forward, even with the kids.
And it's a big question in families, isn't it? Because your husband took time off to look after your daughter, as you've said in interviews before. Now, 51551 is our text number, and someone is already giving out to me for asking, even posing the question, you know, being a sports presenter and so on, particularly being a mother. This text says, I've never heard any interview asking a sports person, how do you manage being a father, says Breed in Killarney. And she's wondering, do you mind being asked that question?
It's a really good question, Breed. And I did mind it before. I minded it an awful lot. I remember going to my first bike race because cycling is my main sport. And I remember after I had Eve, she was maybe 6 months old, and I went away to a big bike race, Paris-Roubaix. And I was only there for maybe 2 days or something. And I remember one of my male colleagues saying to me when he saw me, almost like congratulating me for being away from home and saying, oh, wow, you must really miss your daughter.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, at that stage, I felt completely liberated that I was able to go away from home, that I knew my daughter was being well looked after by my husband, and I was back in the environment that I knew, because motherhood is a really confusing state of being to begin with. Parenthood is, you know, but I was back to doing something that I knew again, and I felt incredibly reassured by that. And so for him to say to me that really my thoughts should have been at home, I felt quite insulted by that. And
yeah.
I thought, well, there's no way any of the other fathers who've just had kids, because I had a male colleague who actually had a child just shortly after, and he wasn't asked about it. I would say that in the years since then, I've become much more aware of the need to maybe to be okay with being asked that question, because other mothers look to other mothers, you know, and if you want to be a working mum in particular, I think you almost need examples of where people can manage to do it. And I've had colleagues say that to me before and say, well, one of my colleagues at Sky, she had a child 2 years ago, and she messaged me when she was pregnant and said, I'm really glad that I can see you on social media and whatnot, continuing with your career with kids, because it gives me reassurance that it's possible. And so I think, unfortunately for all of us, society is still that way. And until it changes, we will still have these questions. So I'm okay with it, because I'm okay with what I'm trying to do with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it almost feels like we're at the start of that process. So if we just ignore it, we don't get the message that you've put so deftly for us there. So I hope it's still okay to ask that question. You put it down so well. Now, I want to come to women's sport. And I've heard the suggestion in Ireland, particularly, where women's sports are saying, we're not looking for equality, we're just looking for fairness. We have another text I just want to read out here. When is the GAA going to have women's camogie in football fully included in their organisation? Every family in this country has contributed in some way to the success of the GAA is today, and this exclusion is no longer tolerable. As a woman, I'm no longer happy to see these women's sports beholden to the goodwill of the men's organisation that receives huge funding from the public coffers, says Sarah in Cork.
It's such a valid point, and it's such an important point. And it's something that my mum, who I'm quite sure is listening right now, gets really angry about, even the lack of coverage for camogie for women's football. And it's a bit of a cyclical thing, really, because any organising body, be it the GAA, be it anyone else, has to proactively take responsibility for pushing and supporting women's sport. And they have to be aware of the fact that the women's side of any game has been done such an historical disservice for such a long time that you cannot then say, oh, well, you know, women's sport doesn't bring in the same amount of money, or it doesn't get the same crowds, or we don't have the same financial reasons for supporting women's sport. Every organising body has to be very aware that it doesn't get the same promotion, it doesn't get the same platform, it doesn't get the same profile as men's sport. So until it does, you cannot expect it to be on a level. And that's where broadcast and print journalism comes into it as well. Yeah. We have to do a much better job across the board of promoting women's sport, of finding the stories and of shouting about all the great sport there is. And I think it's a two-pronged thing from a media point of view, and that's the point of view that I come at it, because I think it's very easy sometimes in the media in particular to point the finger at organising bodies and say, you've got to do this first and then we'll jump on board. Well, actually, we as the media can do something first. Yeah. and demand that organising bodies listen and pay attention. And we can shout about the inequalities, which is important, but we also have to shout about the great women's sport that there is out there. We have to create that appetite and let the public and fans and audiences know that they can watch even more excellent sport, and it just happens to be played by women. And so I think all of that factors in. And then you bring in more money to a sport, and more money brings in better training, better coaching, better facilities, which again then manages to hone that talent going through.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things, even last year we had the Dubs winning the five in a row and everyone's saying it's the first time any GA team has won five in a row, even though the Cork ladies football team, they had done five in a row by 2009. They came back and did six in a row then after that. But no one talks about them as being the greatest team of all time. And Rena Buckley, if I'm not mistaken, has about 18 All-Irelands, but is never referred to as the greatest player. I suppose it's something men can do as well to seek out and support these sports, because who are the viewers of sport? Is it women mostly watching sport? Women's sport?
No, it's mostly men. It's the overwhelming majority of people watching women's sport are men.
Right.
And from my, I would say, considerable experience, when you show men what incredible women's sport there is out there, they're not turning against it or turning off it because it's women. They want to watch sport. Sports fans, be they men or women, want to watch thrilling sport. It doesn't really matter about the gender. And that might sound simplistic, but I have seen it over and over again. And I feel like we just have to frame it differently. We just have to give better promotion. And as you say, you know, to only reference a male team as being the greatest ever or the first to ever succeed in any record or to be the most successful ever, we're just pretending that women's sport doesn't exist. And whose fault is that? That's not the sports people. That's not the organising body. That's all of us. That's the public led by the media.
Yeah. Another text here says, delighted to hear Orla on the radio. A big hello from the son of Dickie Edwards. Dickie would have helped Orla's athletics coaching in Ballinascreen Athletic Club.
Oh, how wonderful. Dickie Edwards was an absolute legend of Ballinascreen Athletics Club. And he's the man who started me on my sporting journey. That's absolutely wonderful to hear. I'm delighted he's tuned in.
A bit of nostalgia for you there. You obviously, like a lot of girls do, they fall away from sport in their teens. So how do you encourage young women to keep with the sport?
I think we have to reframe it for a start. That's an adult responsibility, really, whereby we're highlighting all the joy and the fun that you can get out of sport. So it's we realise we're encouraging girls for their mental well-being as well as their physical well-being. But actually, a big, big, big part of it, and I sound like a broken record when it comes to this, but I do believe so firmly that it comes back to visibility, and it comes back to showcasing the best of women's sports so that they know that cool, beautiful, successful, whatever kind, all kinds of women can compete in sport. Or, you know, you show them a sport. If you've got a teenager who's maybe conscious about their weight, you show them a sport where that doesn't matter, where the women are super strong anyway. And we give them role models. And that we can do, you know, I'm talking about media responsibility, but that we can do whatever your job or whatever your walk of life as a parent. I think it's really important for me to show my daughter female role models in sport. And so I actively encourage her to be watching sport, to be following sport. I'll be telling her what cool woman has done this. You know, we'll sit down and watch the women cycling together so she finds someone to cheer. And that's something that all of us can do, because the beauty these days is that we don't always have to rely on traditional media to be able to access and find our role models. We can look on social media, we can look on YouTube, we can actively seek out female role models to show to our daughters so that they know that it's a cool way to be, and it doesn't have to be only for the sporty girls, and you know, it doesn't have to be for the girls who are not so girly. I'm a really girly girl, but I love sport, and I think we have to showcase all of that for girls, that they know that it's for everyone.
Brilliant. The texts are still rolling in, Orla. I'm addicted to Eurosport cycling. I love listening to the expertise of all its reporters, especially your brilliant guest. We're sort of running out of time, unfortunately, but we love the sound of your voice as well, because you have one of those international voices. The bit of Derry is still in there, but you're living in Amsterdam and working away, and very proud. Everyone's very proud of you back in Derry from what we can gather from our texts coming in. But continued success. I mean, it's all about the cycling. Do you think it's turned a corner now, that sport?
Oh, Oliver, that's the $60 million question. I would say that cycling is in a much, much better place than it was when I was growing up. Is it a clean sport? I think we're naive if we follow any sport and think that it's entirely clean and think that there is no cheating, no doping, no underhand practices, because sport is practiced by human beings, and human beings will push the limits, whatever they are. So I think we can't be naive when it comes to watching any sport.
Listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Orla. The continued success to you. We'll
Thank
keep watching
you so
out
much,
on your sport.
It's been lovely to chat.
Good luck. Take care. Now, welcome back. My guest this morning set up a global movement in 2013. It's called Fashion Revolution. And what it does is it advocates for change in the fashion industry. She wants us to rethink our approach to what we wear and how we wear because of its impact, not just on the planet, but also on its people. Her book, Loved Clothes Last, How the Joy of Rewearing and Repairing Your Clothes Can Be a Revolutionary Act. It's a great read, and she joins us this morning. Ursula De Castro, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Your name is, it sounds steeped in kind of cinematic glamour. You must have a background in fashion going back to an early age.
Well, I have a background in loving fashion since a very early age. I mean, really, all my early memories are confined to the clothes that I was wearing rather than the things that I was doing or the people that I was seeing. So, yeah.
And you grew up in Rome, is that correct?
I grew up in Rome, but from a Venetian family. So my family home is in Venice.
Very kind of very steeped in all of that. And what was your connection to fashion then starting out?
Well, a kind of, you know, traditional heritage connection. My grandmother would crochet. She taught me how to crochet. My mother was a knitter and a clothes transformer. She'd buy something new and chop it and make it different. My aunt was a pattern cutter and a clothes maker in Florence. So it's kind of always been around me, really, this appreciation for well-made, beautiful clothes.
Right. And so in the late 90s, you founded a brand From Somewhere. Tell us what the idea behind that was.
Well, the idea was I really had an orange jumper that I had to wear, but it was full of stains. And so I took my crochet needle and I started embellishing all its defects. Right. Lo and behold, it became a brand. I wore it. Everybody loved it. Within a few months, we were selling internationally. So I was taking something at death's door and bringing it back to life with my own creativity and my manuality. And that was the origin of the brand. I kept on upcycling for rather a large amount of years, secondhand and then pre-consumer waste, which is material discarded by the industry itself. And this journey led me to understand quite how much we're throwing away and how ridiculously and how inefficiently. And so that was it. That was my pledge. I will use my creativity to ensure that waste is a resource.
Rescuing clothes, basically. But your life then basically changed, or your outlook on life, I suppose, changed in 2013 with a disaster, a preventable one, in Bangladesh. Tell us what happened in 2013.
Absolutely. In 2013, I was the co-founder and co-curator of Aesthetica, which was the sustainable fashion area at London Fashion Week. And one of our designers, one of our most successful designers, Carrie Summers, who is Fashion Revolution's other founder, called me pretty much with the idea. You know, we were all running around like headless chicken in frustration after Rana Plaza. You know, the worst I told you so ever.
Yeah.
And Carrie called and said, you know, let's do something. And you know, already with a fully-fledged Fashion Revolution wording idea. So we just set out to construct the team, and which was very much made of individuals that had already met and discussed this thoroughly for years, I think, before. And lo and behold, you know, even before we started, even before the 24th of April 2014, mm-hmm. we already had, you know, 50 countries on board, individuals who really wanted to be a part of this movement and be a part of the change. So it proved really, maybe with my brand, I had been a little bit too pioneer and too early, but with Fashion Revolution, it was absolutely the right time, and this was proved by people's engagement.
Yeah, and Fashion Revolution now in 92 countries around the world. And I mean, the horror stories around fashion just kept on going, didn't they? Even last year we heard about Pakistani workers earning as little than 30 cent an hour making clothes for a very well-known company, Boohoo, of course. They were in the news
over
that.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, you know, this industry designed itself to exploit, designed itself to be opaque. From the very beginning of fashion industrialization, you know, all we need to think of is cotton being picked by enslaved people in the American South, woven here in Victorian sweatshops, and then distributed via the East India Company. I mean, you know, not really the most ethical of starts.
Yeah.
And this is why we need to, A, look back and further, but imagine the future. This is not about really looking back. It's imagining a future where we enter a society where we treat each other as equals. We treat our garment workers with respect. We pay them dignifiedly, and we produce an adequate amount of clothing and not an excessive amount of clothing, which is what we're doing now.
Which we do
we
now.
We need to think, exactly, we need to think of abundance as opposed to exponential growth, abundance and prosperity.
Can you portray, because your book does it in very stark terms, some of the sheer waste and excessive production of clothes that we're enduring right now?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a brilliant one for statistics. You know, the statistics are in my book, but we all know the statistics oscillate and vary according to new data when it comes. So, you know, approximately, we know that at some point in 2015, there was a statistic that said that 150 billion garments of clothing were produced. You know, we can only really assume that since 2015, this number has gone up, not down. We know that since 2000, clothing production has doubled. We also know that when it comes to fiber recycling, we're only really bringing fiber to fiber at 1%. And we know that the statistics of how much we discard is huge. We can't be realistic with that statistic because, yet again, this industry is not transparent. So it doesn't tell us.
So we
how
know
much
it's huge,
waste.
But it's all hidden behind. I mean, we don't really think, do we, about the impact of the fashion socially and environmentally, but it does an enormous amount of damage. The introduction of fast fashion, what do you call a change then from ready to wear to ready to waste that has made things worse?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I'm joking when I call it ready to waste, although I think that's what it should be called. But I think above all, what we need to really look is the narratives that we have around our clothes. I mean, you know, we have been prevailed by the narrative that fast fashion is so badly made that it doesn't warrant any repairs. You should just throw it away and get something new.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, brands have not been defending their products. They're not saying, no, actually, this is my product. It's good. It's made by my garment workers and they're skilled. They're totally letting us buy the narrative because it's convenient for them.
Yeah.
What I try to explain in the book is that we have an opportunity to learn how to mend if we want to ourselves and really think about longevity and care and love and passion when we buy clothes. Brands have an obligation to ensure that the products that they make are repairable. I mean, there is a law in Europe called the right to repair, and this should extend to fashion. You know, fast fashion, although, you know, many people call it badly made, I would prefer to argue that it is, you know, simply made, that it's not as complicated as a beautiful vintage piece, but guess what? That means that it's really simple to repair. I mean, to pick up a hem of a Zara or a Boohoo skirt that's just dropped, it's going to take you about 3 minutes. And even if you do it really, really badly, no one's going to notice. So I'm really advocating for all of these fast fashion stores and supermarkets to put mending facilities in their stores for those of us who either don't have the skill nor the time to actually mend.
Yeah, maybe we just don't have the skill, but it's not as difficult as we think. But mind you, there are even shows now about sewing, aren't there?
Yeah.
A lot of people who are trying to avoid fast fashion, they feel better about themselves if they buy something expensive because they think, well, it's obviously going to be much better, probably better along the supply chain as well, and also it's going to last longer.
It depends what do you mean by expensive and who's made it. I mean, the luxury industry, the premium luxury in particular, is guilty of absolutely the same crimes as the fast fashion. Okay, they may be producing in slightly different areas, but their garment workers are hardly well paid. In fact, there was a recent statistic, I think it was a couple of years ago, a recent study, apologies, that said that very skilled garment workers in Hungary were actually paid less than their equivalent in Bangladesh. And that is, you know, Eastern Europe is very much the hunting ground of production for luxury brands.
Yeah.
I mean, let's speak really plainly. Sustainability is not about buying. Sustainability is about applying different choices to your life and creating different habits. So already thinking that buying expensive is better than buying cheap is kind of a bit of a false start. The thing is, you know, if you want to start on a sustainable journey towards buying something more sustainable, you might detour and end up at the park. But it's like the measure of success, the measure of love, the measure is not the price.
Yes.
Is really how long you are prepared to commit to that piece of clothing.
Not, it's not necessarily, you argue in your book either, that you pay more, that it's better made. They're all kind of made
no,
the same way, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, not all of them, but the majority of what we see on the high street would qualify as main street. And I would say 95% of what we're buying now on our high street is unsustainable. So I'm also trying to change the language. Let's talk about fashion, and by fashion mean what we mean by fashion, an unsustainable fashion, which is the onslaught of products that we are, you know, witnessing right now.
So let's look at someone who's looking at their wardrobe right now. They see the stuff in there and they're listening to what you're saying, but they want to make their clothes last longer. And they're thinking, oh, sure, that thing is in shreds after a few wears. If you want. So what can we do to make clothes last longer?
Well, the first thing for me is to care for them because, you know, I do believe that, again, this narrative of, ooh, they're made so badly means that we're shoving stuff in the machine without really checking what it wants. You know, when we buy food, we have all sorts of things that we do to check, you know, sell by date, does it contain e-numbers, you know. We have to apply those same rules to clothes. You know, look at the label inside. How much, you know, how much can you gauge in terms of, you know, what it contains? But the reality is, if you take a really, really cheap bra and a really expensive bra, but hand wash them with care with a light detergent, which is what you would do to something really expensive, the cheap one will probably end up lasting the same amount of time. Wow. So first of all is understanding that bad quality can, in certain cases, be relative. And you can actually...
But the hand washing is the gentle way, obviously, to look after them.
It's a gentle way, but it's you know, not just hand washing. You could spot clean. I mean, in the book, there's, you know, pages and pages and pages of alternative ways of washing. You know, women, when we have to wash by hand, trust me, we made one wash last a long time till the next.
Yeah.
But the, again, it's where is the responsibility? Because it is up to brands to provide us the information within those labels, be it a physical label or something that is electronic, to tell us what's in those clothes so that we can then apply the proper care. Because we know, we know that polyester releases microfibers. So we need to know the percentage of polyester, and we need to make our own decisions as to how to buy and how to keep. Because the only antidote in a throwaway society such as ours is to keep.
So you've got great practical tips basically on caring for clothes and washing them, steaming, spot cleaning, brushing. Tell us what you do with jeans.
Well, I don't wear very many jeans, I have to be honest. I mean, the last pair of jeans is still in my wardrobe and I probably had it since I was 12. I'm so bored of these fake broken jeans. But I normally paint on them. I mean, especially with my kids when they were little, we had a game. It's actually, the thing is called pareidolia, is when you see shapes like in clouds or, you know, in things. And so we see shapes in stains. So we've had little dogs coming out of an old, you know, pasta with tomato falling on a pair of trousers. We've had all sorts of cute little flowers on shirts and so on.
Yeah, and I mean, learning those symbols, people say, I can't decipher them. You can just look those up very quickly, can't you, and learn about what symbols about.
Yeah, you can learn them. I don't memorize them. But, you know, with mending, I'm not a very good mender at all. This is why the book is more of a...
Okay, so you get the label
why
out.
Why to mend.
You basically look it up and match it. You don't know on site.
Sorry?
You don't know on site, so you, each time, even you're kind of Googling as well.
Absolutely.
What does this thing mean?
No, I don't remember. I have my.
That's good to know. That's reassuring because the rest of us don't
it's
either.
It's inside my wardrobe, absolutely.
The texts are coming in. 51551 is the text, Ursula, and we've got some good suggestions in here. This person says they have a Zara linen jacket they bought in 2010, re-dyed it in 2015. It is still good to wear. That's from Rory.
Absolutely.
In Kerry.
This is exactly what. You see, this is. We need to hear these stories. And, you know, I did a post on my Instagram, which is in my name, also at the castle, and a post a couple of weeks ago saying exactly this thing, you know, that we can care for fast fashion. We have to care for fast fashion because it's not going to go anywhere. It's still going to increase. The only way to stop it is to slow it down. So I've been inundated with stories of people, you know, they're sending me details from, you know, their favorite shirt from Next that they've had 20 years. And, you know, yes, I'm with that lot. You know, I believe that, you know,
this texture here is kind of hitting on it. My kids wouldn't know a needle from a thread. Fast fashion, cheap, affordable stuff is all they want. They don't even wash them. Just buy more is their motto.
That's a problem. Then the parent, I sympathize. But I do have advice for that.
Go on.
You know, the word new. Let's look at what new means. Because if you take something old, I would suggest one of those parents take something of those fast fashion clothes, take them to somebody else to have some, you know, take a T-shirt, have something embroidered on it, a slogan, mended, written on it, bring it back, and then see what they say. Because actually, something old plus some intervention like a beautiful embroidery or even just, you know, rip it with a pair of scissors equals something new.
I love that thing in the book that you're talking about because 1980s fashion is really in, particularly among a certain age group, early 20s, late teens and so on. And you're talking about, for those who were alive in the 1980s, the layering of several cut-up T-shirts that look so cool on Madonna or the punks or the new romantics, the whole grunge thing. These are all testaments to youth taking up the scissors and needles to customise in order to rebel and saying something by looking different. Whereas now the fast fashion industry kind of gives you these pre-worn clothes and then this pretense of rebelling.
It's preposterous. I mean, I'm this, you know, obviously I'm a child of the 80s, but it's so easy to be creative with your clothes and even be a little bit angry with your clothes, the way that we've been made to think that clothes is so stupid. You know, it's such a female industry, so linked with improvement, so linked with innovation, and yet people call it frivolous and treat it as such.
Yeah.
It's a very incisive industry. It has a huge impact on people and planet. And so to be able to, you know, creatively say something about this, make a statement with the clothes that we already have. I think the next generation is more politicized. We're looking at TikTok at the minute, you know, and
yes,
the DIYers on TikTok.
Oh, that's the place
huge
to get them.
I love every single one of them with my whole heart. Yeah. You know, for changing the culture, they're bringing it back. It's amazing.
Yeah, the texts are still rolling. It's a great reaction to the book. I was shocked when my niece told me the pressure on the late teen, the early 20s, was not to wear the same thing twice. Now,
yeah,
as a 24-year-old, finding vintage or second-hand is cool.
Yeah.
Is this a conversation best had in schools? I have a wardrobe of many favourite decades of items. All look different with varied accessories, says Sarah. But, I mean, we put too much pressure on schools and expect teachers to do the parenting and everything for them. I mean, it all begins at home, doesn't it?
Well, it begins at home, but it continues down the road. And this is what I like about social media, because in my case, it certainly has begun at home, but it's become a whole world movement. I mean, you know, loved clothes last in itself. That was something I used to describe my own collections when I was a fashion designer, because that's how I designed. And then it has turned, you know, hashtag loved clothes last is like a massive global movement. And now the book, meaning that you can pass it on, meaning that if you start making those changes in your wardrobe, and you do it in such a way that it's really enthusiastic and, you know, again, not juicing, not a diet, but something that you're just going to carry on. People follow you because it is exciting, because it is creative, because clothes are our chosen skin. And so to, you know, to be able to speak via them what we want is an easy way to become a part of this conversation and ultimately find the solutions that are right for you, because, you know, fashion is about individualism too. So also your interest, your journey, your entry point into fashion and sustainability will be easy to find if you just check what's in your wardrobe.
I'm sitting in a machine mending my jeans and my daughter's leggings. Are young people being taught to mend or sew? Well, I think they are in some ways, because the Great British Sewing Bee is that programme on BBC One.
Yeah.
Amateur sewers taking on the challenges to be named the country's best home sewer. So it's just a matter of the attitude. Now, here's a question. I'm going to one last question to you, Ursula. What does this lady think of fur coats? Beautiful item, but I'm afraid to wear it.
Yes, you're right. So am I. So I inherited my fur coat, actually my great-grandmother's
fur coat.
Sorry,
we just lost you for a second. You inherited your fur coat.
I inherited my great-grandmother and grandmother's fur coat, and I've worn them, unfortunately, as dressing gowns, because I, too, am a little afraid to wear them because of the reaction. I would never in a million years buy a new fur coat.
Uh-huh.
But I would never in a million years wear a fake fur coat.
Right.
I mean, you know, for me, no fur means no fur. So that's what it is. So I wore mine until they died. I wore them with all the love in the world. I treated them as best I could. I put them in a cold room whenever I could. But it was a personal choice and not one that I was necessarily happy to discuss with the rest of the world. I do believe that if you want to wear a fur coat, you've got two options. One would be fake, and the other one would be real secondhand. But I actually would advocate for secondhand also for the fake.
Yeah.
And, you know, with global warming,
but if you've done it,
only if you need it,
if it's
for
yours and you're reusing it, what harm? Particularly when you've got such a sentimental link. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Ursula De Castro, Loved Clothes Last is the book, How the Joy of Rewearing and Repairing Your Clothes Can Be a Revolutionary Act. Good morning to you.
Thank you.
Matt Haig has become very well known over the last 6 of 7 years. His book Reasons to Stay Alive really resonated with readers. That was his difficult but life-affirming memoir of his mental health struggles. But his latest novel, The Midnight Library, a huge hit among the Tubridy team, is no different. It's already a massive bestseller. It might just have some lessons on how to cope with adversity and how to stop wishing for a better, different life. Matt, good morning to you. I suppose, can I ask you, how much of the premise do you want to give away, or how far up to it do you want to give away?
Basically, the Midnight Library of the title is this infinite library between life and death, which the main character, Nora, finds herself in after, she's taken an attempt on her own life. Her life was at sort of rock bottom, and then she finds herself in this infinite library where every single book on the shelf is a different version of her own life if she had lived it a different way. And to access those lives, she has to take a book off the shelf, open it up. But the thing is, she has to really find the life that's for her, a life that's worth living, because the library will sort of crumble to dust and her with it if she doesn't find that life. That's basically it.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible because it starts out very grim. I mean, you're in the life of Nora Seed and you can see there's no hope. And then suddenly it just opens up all these endless possibilities in life. And that's why people, I think, are really into it. Did you want Nora to have very different lives? How did you choose where she was going to go from the Midnight Library?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wanted it to be a mix of lives which were relatively close to her own, relatively sort of realistic ones, and then throw in a few wilder ones, because the whole sort of point of the idea of a multiverse is that, you know, almost any version of our life could be lived somewhere. So there is the life where she's like an Olympic medalist, you know, a champion swimmer. There's a life where she's a super clever scientist, a glaciologist in the Arctic Circle. There's a life where she's a rock star. But there's also the lives which are a bit more closer to home, the life where she sort of stayed with the guy who she broke up with, the life where she's a sort of wife and mother, the life where she's an academic, all different paths that she could have taken.
It's great fun. It must have been great crack coming up with it.
It was great fun. It was a bit of a nightmare as well, because obviously when you're writing about different lives with the same people, you're kind of writing 12 mini novels in one. So even if the chapters are super short, and I'm a big fan of short chapters, you're still having to do a lot of research. Certainly, like if you're setting a scene in the Arctic Circle, you have to know more than you're actually putting on the page to look like you know what you're talking about. But yeah, it was great fun.
I mean, it's the best kind of, I suppose, quasi-fantasy, because it's so rooted in reality. But there is a fair bit of science to it as well, isn't there?
I didn't want to get too bogged down with the science, because, you know, no one wants to read a sort of science textbook. But I also wanted people to actually believe in the Midnight Library. So there is, halfway through, there's this character called Hugo. I won't explain the full purposes, therefore, but he explains the science behind it. And I don't consider myself a science person. Science was always my worst subject at school. But as an adult, I get so much inspiration and fascination from science. And I feel like, you know, the latest scientific theories, a lot of quantum physics and stuff, does suggest the idea of parallel universes and uncertainty. And I love that. I love that concept. And I love the concept that we can enter a different universe simply by making a different decision in our life. So a lot of that stuff's in there.
Particularly because in Nora's universe, of course, it's dramatically, her life is dramatically different, but there are shades of familiarity to the kind of root life that she's kind of left behind momentarily.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. So, it's not really a sort of collection of little episodes. She's learning as she goes, and she's seeing the same characters as she goes, because obviously she's got the same brother in every life, she has the same parents in every life, she has, you know, the same best friend in a lot of her lives as well. And so her relationship with those people subtly changes through the book.
The Midnight Library, it's just one of those books that people reading it, they've had lots of eureka moments about themselves, haven't they? And they're sharing them with you as they go along.
Yeah, that's the nice thing. And that was quite unexpected, really. I mean, you never know when you're writing a book how it will resonate with other people. All you can do, if you want to write truthfully, you have to sort of know your own taste and know what you would want to read. And that's the only reader you'll ever truly know is yourself. So you're kind of self-indulgently writing a book for yourself and then hoping other people will get something out of it. With the Midnight Library, it was almost like self-therapy for me. It was a way of coming to terms with my own life and possible regrets, and, you know, I've always struggled with self-acceptance, and it was basically me trying to sort my own mind at in this book, and it's lovely to see that it's doing that to other people as well.
It's incredible that you kind of even share that idea. I mean, you've sold millions of books. You've had, in many ways, kind of parallel universe careers, even as a writer, haven't you?
Well, yeah, but I did my time as, your archetypal struggling writer. I was like, I think, it makes me sound super old. I'm only 45, which isn't ridiculous, but I think this is book number 20, if you put them all together. A lot of people think the first book I wrote was a book about my mental health called Reasons to Stay Alive, but that was actually my 10th book. I wrote a lot of books that no one read. For a long time, I was, very much under the radar. So I've seen it from both sides. But yeah, the Midnight Library has definitely, placed me up a notch. But it's just lovely as a writer because writing itself, you're always alone. Whatever stage you're at in your career, when you're writing a book, it's just you, your laptop, your Word document. And that is actually the best bit of writing because that's when it's all possibility and that never changes. That's the bit that's consistent, whether you're an unpublished writer starting out or, you're Stephen King, whatever, that's the bit that's sort of pure. And that's the bit you have to stay loving if you want to stay doing stuff people want to read, I think.
So it was 10 years writing books before you got the big hit, and it was really because it was true to yourself.
It took me, when I cringe a little bit when I'm looking back at some of those early books, because it took me a while to find my voice. So I wouldn't exactly say if you like The Midnight Library, you should definitely read everything I've ever written, because some of those early books, they were sort of very dark, and a lot of them were written while I was still in recovery and or depressed and stuff. So I was a very different writer back then. It's almost like when you look at old photos of yourself and your hair was some terrible fashion from 1997 or something, and you cringe at the memory. And it's kind of like that. I sort of got, I'm fond of them because they're, things that came from my mind at a certain point in time. But yeah, there's a little bit of cringe there too.
But the cringe is part of you, and you now accept
Exactly. I accept it all.
I mean, talk about people who take bits of the book out and they're sharing it around. I mean, I'm one of those people. I actually photographed bits of the book as I went along. I love this quote. And I'm always looking for kind of, insights into the author's mind. And maybe you tell me I'm completely wrong. But it's one that's actually I've noticed other people were lifting. And it says, maybe that's what all lives were. Maybe even the most seemingly perfectly intense or worthwhile lives ultimately felt the same. Acres of disappointment and monotony and hurts and rivalries, but with flashes of wonder and beauty. So...
Yeah, we kind of need the darkness, I think, sometimes to see the light, isn't it? That's how we see the stars in the sky. Yeah. And I get very sentimental about this because obviously I went through, like a lot of people, I went through experiences of depression. I was suicidal for a good deal of time. And I would never in a million years want to relive those sort of darkest days. But I also think by the same token that without that experience, I would not have known so much happiness and gratitude in the present. So I feel like we kind of need it together. We know what happiness is and contentment is and calmness is because we also know what the opposite is, and that is part of life, and we can't sometimes separate the one from the other, and that's actually quite healing to come to terms with that, I think.
Yeah, to even just slow down and consider that as something, but it's full of those little nuggets. And also you do some great quotes as well. The life of a human, according to the Scottish philosopher David Hume, was of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster.
Yeah, he was apparently really fun at dinner parties as well, thank you. There you go.
Just in the middle of the main course after someone's told a joke, just land that little nugget. We're just as important as an oyster, really. And by the way, because Nora gets to visit different parts of her life, are there things when you were writing it that you're thinking, yeah, I might like to go back to that place and maybe change that little thing that I did, but in a good way?
Always. It's funny, the very last bit I wrote in The Midnight Library, it wasn't the last page in the book as the reader reads it. The last thing I wrote, it comes about halfway through, which is a piece about embracing your imperfections and stuff. And that was me basically saying, okay, enough. Just leave the novel there. And the moment you send it off, there's always things you wish you'd done. More so with nonfiction. I think nonfiction, it's easier to sort of do something that you can imagine is perfect. Obviously, it's not perfect, but you imagine it's perfect when you pick it. With a novel, there are always these sort of imperfect, baggy things that you could change in any which way. But you have to get a point where you just say, okay, if I keep changing anymore, it's actually going to get worse because I'm going to overfiddle with it, overthink it. And there's a sort of sweet spot between, you know, not doing any editing at all, which would be terrible, and then doing too much and tinkering around too much. And you've just got to sort of know when you're at that point where you're getting too worried about it. And then before you get there, you just send it off. So, yeah, it's a totally imperfect book, but it's a totally human book, and I, you know, put my heart into it.
That's kind of the life, isn't it? You can't go back and change a little bit
exactly.
if you want as well. Did you make any changes to your own life?
I mean, well, with this book was actually just quite a healing process for me.
All right.
But it's almost about not worrying too much about what I couldn't change. It was, you know, not worrying too much about what I have regretted in the past. I don't really have regrets anymore. I mean, the only regret I really have, you know, like I used to be quite good at the piano, and then I stopped playing the piano at 14 because I was like self-conscious teenage boy. You know, all the lads were playing football. I just felt, you know, not right going to Mrs. Peters on a Friday evening playing the piano. So stupidly, I stopped playing the piano. And I tried to pick it up at the age of 45, and I'm doing it with my 12-year-old son, who is amazing because he's 12, so he just learns things so fast. And there's nothing more humiliating being 45 years old trying to learn the same skill with a 12-year-old who just is like a sponge, and you're there stuck at the same level. But no, I don't really do regret. So this book was very much me trying to just accept where I am and be happy with where I am and be happy for all the mistakes and all the journey and the struggles and all the rest of it and all the things I've done.
All those little wounds along the way, and big wounds are all part of the whole experience. I want to ask kind of because you're very big on social media, on Twitter. You've, you know, roughly 500,000 followers on Twitter alone, and you really get stuck in, don't you? You get involved. You're not afraid.
Well, yeah, I've probably got too stuck in the past. I'm actually trying to be a bit more afraid.
Right.
Because I feel like, I feel like social media is a double-edged sword. It's great as a writer because you can connect to people. You know, it levels that playing field between writer and reader. You can talk to people. You can get engaged in politics.
Yes.
I'm finding actually Instagram is my place. I know people are very cynical about Instagram and they think it's all just sunsets and unicorns, but I actually need a bit of that. I need
yes.
a bit of people being friendly, because I feel like Twitter, sometimes people just go for the argument, and that's fine. Sometimes when you're feeling heated about something political, that's okay. But, you know, as a day-to-day thing in life, I'm trying to get a little bit calmer. So I'm heading over to the sunsets and...
Very nice. I mean, Twitter is life in block capitals, isn't it? Whereas
exactly.
Instagram
is shouty.
Is italics. Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe that's one of it. But you're very shy. Do you think, by the way, has all that cruelty always just been there in the world? All the snarks and the meanness and the flashes of kindness, sometimes peppered with division and alongside nice photos of baby pandas or something?
Yeah,
has it always been there?
Human nature hasn't fundamentally changed, but I think what has changed is we're a bit overloaded by it now. We didn't always have rolling news. We didn't have, you know, every day seeing something that we had to be offended about that every hour of every day. I think that's changed. And I think, like, certain social media sites like Twitter, their sort of business model runs on that.
Yes.
Sort of, so it's not like human nature's changed, but it's being exploited in slightly newer ways. Which
it's
I'm a
literally
bit,
designed,
know.
Isn't it? To,
yeah,
to keep
exactly.
us on it and divide it, and that generates more and more eyeballs and so on.
Yeah.
The Midnight Library is out on paperback, which is why we're chatting to you today. So, but you have another book out in the summer, don't you? Which...
I do, yeah. As I was sort of, as I finished Midnight Library, and I felt a bit at a loss, also because, you know, it was 2020, March last
yes,
year.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask. You wrote a book, another one in lockdown.
Yeah, I wrote, so to keep my mind sane and not, you know, spend all my time on Twitter or looking at, you know, horrible statistics about COVID, I wrote a book called The Comfort Book, which was just me writing... anything I could think of that comforts me, you know, and using other people's quotes, even recipes in there. There's everything, you know, my favourite movies, different things. So it's a sort of book that you can pick up, not, you know, read from start to finish, but to sort of like page 105 or whatever and just hopefully find something.
That sounds like something else we need as well. What was that experience like? Because I presume you had homeschooling and all of that to do.
Yes, indeed. We're one of those weird people who even homeschool anyway. We've homeschooled our kids for a few years now for all kinds of reasons. But so we didn't have the same level of transition a lot of people had, you know, because obviously I'm a writer, I work from home. we homeschool our kids anyway. I mean, it is a bit different because the place, the town we're in England, in Brighton, it's quite homeschooly. There are a lot of homeschool kids even in normal times. So they're normally out of groups, so we had them in the house. So, yeah, that was a bit different. But this was the easiest book I've ever written in some ways, the comfort book, because it was, it didn't have to be written in order. It didn't have a story. I could sort of dip into it and out of it whenever I wanted. It was just little flashes of anything that would comfort me, you know, looking up quotes on the internet. So it was very much a thing I could do around the homeschooling, around the real life stuff. I could even just do it for half an hour on an evening or whatever, and I could just get into it. So it was quite an easy write. So hopefully it'll be an easy
It was a good idea, and you were probably writing it halfway through thinking, actually, they won't need this in 2021. It'll be over, but unfortunately,
yeah,
we
well,
do.
Exactly. Yeah. But I deliberately didn't mention the words COVID or pandemic or coronavirus. They're not there. I don't think we need to see those words over and over again more than we have to in the news anyway. So, yeah, hopefully it's beyond 2020.
That's coming soon, but The Midnight Library, as we say, is out 15 weeks. The New York Times bestseller charts, I saw you tweeting that. That's not shabby at all, is it?
Yeah, it's me showing off on social media again. I think it's just because I get surprised myself, because I have been that struggling writer. This isn't my first book, so
yes.
I'm kind of grateful for it all, basically.
Well, it's good that you're still getting the thrill out of it, you know, because some people could get blasé about that. It was a very enjoyable book, as well as just having, you know, kind of the timeless message that finding meaning in the suffering, and when you can change your circumstances, maybe you can change your attitude towards them.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, last year I got into a lot of the old Stoic philosophy, like the ancient Greeks, and there was this guy called Epictetus, I think that's how you pronounce it. Anyway, he was a slave and eventually a freed slave, and he came up with basically the ancient version of, like, cognitive behavioral therapy. He was like, you cannot change the external things. All we can change is our responses to them. And it's a hard place to get to that place, but once you do, I think that's where freedom is.
Well, let's hope people find the little nuggets for the overall recipe along the way in The Midnight Library.
Indeed.
Matt Haig, thanks a million. Good morning.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Take care. Bye-bye.